ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts. So, Chris Herring, there is this video that I think about a lot too often, honestly. The city has turned it into this mythological artifact already. It is from after the Knicks season opening win against the Boston Celtics this season, and I think it truly captures the spiritual essence of Knicks fans.
Double f***ing overtime! What the f***, baby? New York is f***ing back!
Knicks are here, baby! The Knicks are f***ing here, baby!
Fresh out the garden, baby! We're taking it all the way!
Bing bong!
So I'm just wondering, when you see that video, when you hear that sound, what do you think?
It makes me think it's been so long, seemingly, since there's been something good, and fans have to have something to unleash all of that.
Chris Herring is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated, and his book, Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks, is out now.
And in that case, it was a single win over a team that's not even that good. You know, there's no way of knowing that on opening night, maybe. But this fan base is just so rabid and is just in such anticipation of something happening because it's just been such a long time since they've had a damn thing. The last reference point that fans have of my age, your age, you know, older than that, is those 90s teams. And I think that that was really almost sort of a spiritual thing, even when you look back at those videos and the starting lineup introductions.
Say, go New York, go New York, go!
And you'd see all of these Wall Street people coming to the game straight from work in their suits. It really did feel spiritual on some level, and people have told me that from even the way that the garden is lit when you're watching the game, that it feels almost more like a church service.
And now, please welcome the Atlantic Division champions.
You think about the city, you know, if you're looking at it from the most technical sense, they've got a couple of basketball teams. But as we've seen from, you know, every time the Nets have to run one of those promotions where James Harden is going to buy your tickets for you, you know, they've got one basketball team. When you add that in, where it's really the only team in the city, and we're going on 25 years now since the last time they went to the finals, almost 50 since they've won their last championship. I think most people feed into that.
So yes, right now, the New York Knicks are this completely mediocre basketball team. They are not even close to being the best team in their city. And the amount of just therapy they've sent their fan base into over decades now is beyond calculation. But New York City does remain a Knicks town. And that's not particularly close either. The city absolutely bleeds blue and orange. And at no time did that blood run more freely than in Madison Square Garden in the 1990s, thanks to a team that turned basketball into a street fight. So today, Chris Herring explains how a team that played wondrously ugly basketball actually gave birth to the beauty of the modern NBA. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, January 19th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Chris, this book that you've written has a phenomenal title, Blood in the Garden, and it is out now. I just want to say congrats on the front end here, because I imagine all of this has felt like a birth.
I really appreciate the kind words, and I'm really proud of this. It's the first time I've tried to do something along these lines, and you know, there are times where I hated what I was writing, but now I'm pretty proud of it now.
There are times when I hated what you were writing too, but it wasn't because of the writing. It's because it described my childhood, and it got a little real, Chris. I mean, look, this is a team that has a fan base that still cries out for those championship teams in the 70s, the near championship teams in the 90s as a result become, as we said at the top here, kind of like these sacred totems, so much so that MSG, the Garden, we call it the Mecca of basketball, completely unironically. So why is it that you in particular wanted to focus on the 90s Knicks and that era in specific?
You know, we got the 10-part documentary on Michael Jordan, and we get like a complete 360 view of all that from their perspective and from the teams that have the dynastic runs. You know, we probably hear too much about those teams after a certain point. Mm. It's a lot more rare to kind of hear about the teams that finish in second all the time that really have a role in defining the era as well. Not only were they a team that kind of threatened to kind of upend what was the dynasty of that era, but I think also the way that they pushed the rules to the limit and, you know, stepped over those lines repeatedly, the personalities that were a part of that team, and just kind of this idea that they were the team that really didn't belong at the dance, but was going to try their damnedest to get there anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there is a quote in specific speaking to the style of this team, the culture of this organization. There's a quote from Horace Grant that feels like it summarizes exactly what it felt like to play against this team.
Yeah, he said, essentially, when I used to walk into the Garden to play the Knicks, I didn't know if we were going to win, but I always knew we were going to bleed. Pat Riley took over the Knicks the same year Magic Johnson would end up walking away because of the HIV diagnosis. And so this was right when the league implemented the rules about having to leave the game at least briefly if you started bleeding. There was one game in particular during a playoff series between the Knicks and the Bulls. The Knicks had one quarter against the Bulls and a third quarter, where they ended up sending Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and John Paxson to the bench all kind of in succession because they were all bleeding.
Well, the Bulls certainly have expected the physical play by the Knicks to continue, but now cuts being dealt out. I see Scottie Pippen has a Band-Aid on his chin, and he's over the...
That's how physically they were playing. You know, Michael Jordan talked at one point about just dreading having to play the Knicks, because he feared and he knew that the Knicks were going to be trying to take his head off.
You know, they came at us very aggressively. We looked at the Detroit series, and we thought they would be a little tired going through a five-game series, but they came out even more eager and more aggressive than we were, and we have a tough time trying to change that momentum back in our favor as of right now.
When you talk about Riley, Chris, I mean, look, prior to him arriving, right, in the early 90s, it's worth mentioning here, the Knicks were not a good basketball team. There were a couple of bright spots here and there. Rick Pitino had a good season, blah, blah, blah. But even with Patrick Ewing there, getting drafted, of course, in 1985, famously, frozen envelope lottery, etc., this was a team that was mediocre. And then Pat Riley gets there, and all of these things that you're describing, how would you begin to characterize his philosophies when it came to his arrival in New York from the very beginning?
It was a complete 180 from what he'd been doing in Los Angeles.
Nixon in the front court, 3-on-3. Left side to Magic. Magic all the way. Spin it up and in.
With Magic at the controls, the Lakers' fast break style became known as Showtime.
I think Pat Riley very wisely looked at the roster and said, that's not going to be possible here. He didn't have guys that could just kind of run up and down the floor. He looked at who the powerhouse was, or who the powerhouse was becoming, and Michael Jordan and the Bulls. Essentially, he took what the Pistons had been doing and looked at what the Pistons had been doing with the Bad Boys and said, you know, it's not too bad of a strategy.
You know, we're going to be the best conditioned, hardest working, most professional, unselfish, toughest, nastiest, most disliked team in the NBA.
And part of that was going to be hacking opponents so relentlessly that the officials eventually had to stop calling fouls. And that was his idea, was a really physically imposing team that really wasn't concerned about the way they were perceived. It was a team that practiced longer than anybody, that treated its shoot-arounds the same way that other teams treated their full-scale practices. He had them on edge constantly.
Well, when you talk about people being on edge, yes, it is opponents. Yes, it is teammates. Yes, it is coaches. And over all of this, right, is the godhead of Pat Riley. I mean, I'll use this word, I think, appropriately. Tell me how insane Pat Riley really was in terms of him and his paranoia and his desire to be that one figure in control of everything here.
I mean, where do you even start? Pat Riley didn't basically want anybody else being able to speak directly to his players. Had a problem with the idea of the team psychologist being able to work with the players. Team scouts, people that worked for the team, had to give prior notice if they wanted to come and watch practice, because Pat Riley did not want people around the team that weren't around the team every day.
I have found myself over the last 4 or 5 years becoming more and more insulated, less and less accommodating. To me, that is perceived as somebody who is all of a sudden becoming aloof and becoming arrogant and becoming detached. But I think that's the only way you can survive.
Not to mention the idea of him asking the film coordinator to gin up videos of car crashes and Rams headbutting each other violently to try to get the team to play more violently on defense. Not to mention that he would ask the team trainer to go get him baseball spikes so that he could slide into the pregame talk that he was going to give to his team.
Oh, man.
Basically to say that always play aggressively, as if you're sliding into somebody with your spikes up. Not to mention the idea of him dunking his head underwater for 2, 3, 3.5 minutes at a time, just so that he can come out gasping for air and then saying, "You all should want to win as much as I needed that breath I just took." Again, when we talk about stuff that would not fit today's standards, a lot of that is relevant to Pat Riley.
Let's talk about the soldiers in the foxhole with him, because the guys on this roster that embodied that unhinged intensity, I mean, give us the casting call.
So you had Patrick Ewing, obviously. You start with that. And, you know, interestingly enough, I don't think, for as tough as he was not the guy who was really instigating much. You know, I think if anything, he was the guy they were looking to protect because they needed him. He was too important to really get in fights and too important to really give up his body any more than he already was. But they sure as hell were going to protect him. If you look back at videos and stuff like that from those years, I mean, you can start with Charles Oakley, certainly.
Oh, look out. Vinny Del Negro is heard. Oakley called for the foul. And it's called a flagrant foul on Oakley.
Charles Oakley had more flagrant fouls, I believe, in one season than like half the entire league.
He did. I think one year he had 9, and there were 15, 16 teams that had fewer than that.
Couple of fakes, and Oakley hammers it, and that's going to be a flagrant foul. And rightfully so. Charles Oakley, I think, has been ejected from the game.
You had John Starks that at times felt like he wasn't wired all the way either. There was a play where he took out Kenny Anderson on a fast break. Kenny Anderson broke his wrist.
John Starks, and Anderson is shaken up.
Kenny Anderson basically told me that he had to tell his boys not to ambush John Starks coming out of the locker room. And then there's Anthony Mason, who, I mean, Manute Bol wanted to throw hands with Anthony Mason. Like, the docile Manute Bol.
And then Mason and 7'7" Manute Bol square off. Bol throwing not what you call a classic left hook, and he was ejected from the game.
Anthony Mason was a guy that, you know, over the course of my reporting, would fly off the handle so quickly. Opponents, teammates, basically was told by a couple of assistant coaches that he essentially left a death threat for Don Nelson over not getting enough playing time during a season where he led the league in minutes.
92, let's start there, right? Because that is the roster on the court here. This is a team that was winning 51 games. They also, as you say, led the league in fouls, wasn't close. And in the playoffs that year, they do get Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls. Riley's strategy to defend Michael Jordan here. How would you characterize that, Chris?
Pat Riley, he had his film coordinator build a video where, if you've ever seen Clockwork Orange, there's that scene where the main character is kind of forced to watch a really disturbing scene repeatedly.
Yes, his eyes are like held open.
Exactly. Pat Riley had his film coordinator take a video from the year before Pat Riley was there, of Michael Jordan driving the baseline, putting a really nasty half-spin move on Charles Oakley, John Starks, and then just tomahawk dunking over Patrick Ewing at the rim and getting fouled.
Jordan trying to shake off Starks. Oh, what a move by Jordan! It counts! And the foul!
He had the video coordinator play that video on a 5 or 6 minute loop.
Just that over and over again for five or six minutes?
That one play over and over again for 5 or 6 minutes.
Jordan trying to shake off Starks. Oh, what a move by Jordan! It counts! And the foul!
He made them watch it repeatedly for those 5 or 6 minutes. And then he turned it off and he said, "This makes me sick." And that was when he told the Knicks players that he literally wanted them to knock Michael Jordan to the floor if and when he decided to come into the paint. So Michael, in response to that, basically said that the series had been a nightmare, that he just wanted it to be over. He only took 3 shots out of 25 in the painted area in game 6 because he was like a receiver hearing footsteps.
Jordan bumping and chatting with Starks.
But Starks made him go away from the basket with a very difficult shot.
Loose ball foul.
The Knicks won that game by 13, 14 points to take it to a game 7.
And then, Chris, Jordan did what Jordan always does. He wins the series deciding game.
Right, but it gave the Knicks something to build on at that point because they realized they could go toe-to-toe with the Bulls.
Coming up, how MJ exacts his revenge on Pat Riley and the Knicks, and how Madison Square Garden welcomed a new villain.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
So, Chris, the Knicks and Pat Riley have discovered now that they can play with Michael Jordan, they can play with the Bulls, if they play this extremely physical, extraordinarily bruising, quite frankly, ugly form of basketball. How did they go about selling this team to the city and their fan base?
The Knicks marketing staff had a field day after that first year because think about it. Fast forward from a 39-win season and just barely making the playoffs to that 7-game series they play against the Bulls, who would go on to win a second title that year. They were amped up because they kind of were not expecting to be good that quickly.
Yeah.
So not only are they good, but all of a sudden they've got an identity for the first time as well. They start marketing the team around the toughness that they've shown and around the physicality that they've shown. So there was a meeting that the marketing staff had with Pat Riley and a number of other people from the organization. And they brought in mock-ups of promotional posters. And the thing that they brought in first, I think they had a visiting ad agency kind of come and present the idea jokingly. but they brought in a promotional poster of an aerial shot of Madison Square Garden. And within that shot, they had a chalk outline of a body sitting in the middle of the painted area in front of the rim. And then underneath that, it said tough town, tough team, the 1992-93 New York Knicks. And even Pat Riley was kind of taken aback by that and said, we can't do this with the messaging. It's a little bit too much. It's a little bit too far. And that was when they had to remind Pat that these were just mock-ups that were just jokes. And he was like, oh, okay. I wasn't in on the joke. I didn't know.
So in 92-93, Chris, the Knicks go on to win 60 games. But the season, ultimately, it gets defined by one specific play in Game 5 of the Eastern Conference Finals. And the series at this point is tied at 2. The Knicks can take control of the thing with a win here. But forward Charles Smith, man, the one guy who really did not embody the toughness of the rest of those Knicks, he misses 4 straight point-blank layups.
Ewing for Smith.
The Bulls go on to win the title. The Knicks have been eliminated. In the offseason, Pat Riley decides to take a vacation to Maui. But he runs into an obstacle of sorts there. So what exactly happened?
So just imagine that, you know, you lose in the most heartbreaking fashion. You mentioned the Charles Smith stuff. You're trying to just get away for a while and just trying to reset mentally, spiritually. Pat Riley goes to Maui, and when he gets there, he is in the middle of the trip with his family, and he has the presidential suite because it's Pat Riley. Of course he does. He gets a call from the front desk saying, you know, Mr. Riley, we're so sorry. Something really unforeseen has come up. We're going to need you to exit the room. We're going to need your family to leave the room. We will get you set up in the next nicest accommodation we have, but something kind of out of our control has come up. Pat Riley's obviously really angry because, you know, you've got Pat Riley money. You can stay where you want to. You certainly pay enough to not be inconvenienced that way.
Mr. Armani suit does not get knocked down to the second best suite.
Exactly. So eventually they try to smooth it over with him. They promise that they'll send up multiple staffers to kind of move their bags and their things so that he doesn't have to worry about it. They just really need them out of the room. So, you know, they decide to go down to a pool. And then Pat Riley is still really curious, like, what on earth could have happened that in the middle of my stay, not like the last day he's there or anything like that, that would move him out of the room. So he's kind of glancing up at his suite repeatedly to try to get a better glimpse, a better sense of what happened here. It's a few minutes later that he looks up at the top suite and sees the doors to the balcony fly open and sees Michael Jordan standing there in a bathrobe, just kind of peering down at his domain, which apparently includes Hawaii. And it's just another reminder of Michael Jordan always being on top, even when you're on vacation, even when you're not even in the 48 states, the lower 48, you know, you can't really escape this guy.
But the Knicks do eventually escape Jordan because Michael Jordan himself escapes the NBA. He retires for the first time in 1993. Only to be replaced, Chris, as New York's preeminent villain by the Pacers and by Reggie Miller in specific, who is almost a more haunting character, I would say, because now we're in 1994. The Knicks are playing Reggie in the playoffs, and there is yet another Game 5 incident that is uniquely seared into the brains of Knicks fans.
Yeah, I mean, it seems crazy to say it out loud, but I also think it might be accurate. There was a certain artistry that Jordan had, and also just the idea that he wasn't just doing that to just the Knicks. It was to everybody, and he was beating everybody. So there was a certain level of, like, you almost have to respect it.
Yes.
With Jordan. Even if you don't like it, you almost have to respect it. Ain't none of that true with Reggie Miller. This felt like it was just the Knicks, right? Like, you know, that he was only doing this to the Knicks. You look at 94, and he had the moment with Spike Lee. three quarters of the way through the game, he's shooting terribly. Spike Lee is loving it because he and Reggie Miller have made a bet. Reggie had asked for a role for his wife in Spike's next film. You know, if Reggie loses the series, if the Pacers lose the series, then Reggie has to go visit Mike Tyson in prison in Indiana. That's what Spike's rules were for the bet.
A brilliant bit of stakes, yeah.
Right. So Spike is loving it because, you know, everything is going the Knicks' way that game. They were up by 12 to 15 points for most of the game. And then all of a sudden the fourth quarter happens and Reggie hits his first shot and then he just doesn't miss.
Here's Butler. Swings away. Discussion with Spike Lee.
He goes off for 25 points in that fourth quarter, and each time he makes a basket, he's looking directly over at Spike Lee.
Reggie Miller giving the choke sign to Spike Lee. Spike is appealing to the official.
Corey Gaines, who was roommates with Reggie Miller during college, who was on the Knicks bench during that, he kept saying, man, somebody's got to get over there to Spike and tell him to just shut up because Reggie feeds off this sort of thing. Spike never knew exactly how to shut up, and Reggie did his thing, and that was just the first of many times that he would just really kind of tear a hole in the Knicks.
So the good news that year was that the Knicks ultimately would survive Reggie. They would beat the Pacers in that specific series. The bad news, of course, is that they would go on to lose the NBA Finals in seven games to the Houston Rockets and Hakeem Olajuwon. And then the next year, they see Reggie Miller and the Pacers again in 95, and this is when Reggie Miller proved that he could rip out a human heart in just 8.9 seconds.
Oh, yeah. I mean, maybe when you really think about it, too, like maybe the sequence that really changes things for the Knicks entirely when you realize what's coming after. Game one of that series, they're up by 6 points, and all they've got to do, literally all they've got to do, is just kind of go to the line, close the game out that way. So the Knicks are probably a 99.9 odds of winning the game. Reggie Miller hits a three.
Miller for three, and he got it. Reggie Miller with a clutch three, and it's 105-102.
And so it's like, okay, so the breathing room's a little bit less, but there's nothing to worry about. You're still up by plenty. But then what ends up happening is that they inbound the ball. Their best inbounders out of the game. Derek Harper had been ejected earlier. So they're inbounding with Anthony Mason. And Mason is looking around trying to pass the ball in. Reggie Miller ends up kind of shoving in the back Greg Anthony, who was who Mason was trying to pass the ball to. Greg Anthony falls over. Reggie Miller catches a pass. And he goes back to shoot a three.
And a steal.
And just in those two sequences, Reggie Miller has tied the game. It was a 6-point deficit when it all started. And all of a sudden, the game is tied. It happens so fast in 8 seconds. The Knicks, they don't even realize what's happened. The Pacers were also caught off guard by how quickly it all happened. They fouled not knowing that the game was tied. And the Knicks are still so thrown off by everything that happened that John Starks, normally a pretty good free throw shooter, goes to the line and misses both shots.
Starks misses.
After that, the Pacers get to go to the line, and Reggie Miller hits two free throws there, and they win the game.
And Pat Riley is saying, what is going on here?
The Pacers executives were so frustrated with the way that game was playing out. They were back in the locker room smoking, you know, stressed out and everything. They didn't even realize what had happened until after the Pacers had won the game. Everybody figured that game was over, that it was going to be a 1-0 Knicks lead in the series. But they dropped that game, and it has huge ramifications for the rest of what's to come right after that series.
That's the series where Reggie Miller becomes the clutchest human being who has ever clutched before. Patrick Ewing infamously misses the finger roll at the buzzer to lose Game 7, becoming the least clutch person who's ever not clutched before.
Inbounds to Ewing. Down to three. Down to two. Ewing. And it's all over. The Indiana Pacers have defeated the New York Knicks to take
the series in seven, and they advance to the...
What was Pat Riley's state of mind, Chris, after all of that, after that Game 7 loss in that fashion to Indiana in 95?
Beneath all this stuff, Pat Riley was just... He was kind of at wit's end with the Knicks. He felt like he was being tuned out by some of the players. He felt like the Knicks had been dishonest with him about certain things as it related to ownership stake and the idea of being able to get an ownership stake. And oh, by the way, he had one of his best friends in the world who had been trying to buy the Miami Heat, who'd been up for sale a few months earlier. It didn't quite work out. Mickey Arison got the team instead. But then his friend that tried to buy the Miami Heat then kind of lured Mickey Arison into saying, like, look, well, Pat would have been interested in coaching the Miami Heat if I'd bought them. You might still be able to talk him into it if the money's right. And so literally 1 hour, maybe less than 1 hour, after that Game 7 was over between the Knicks and the Pacers, and after just a heartbreaking loss that ends their season, Pat Riley got on the team bus, the Knicks team bus, and essentially called his friend and said, you know, that Miami situation that we were talking about earlier, call him up because I'm out of here. I'm done with New York. I don't want to be here anymore.
All right, up next, why we would never have gotten Steph Curry without Charles Oakley.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So from there, Chris, I mean, we know how the rest of the 90s go, right? The Knicks make the finals in the lockout shortened season in 98-99, but Patrick Ewing tears his Achilles. The Spurs beat the Knicks in five. No championship, no title. This is the second place team of New York City's very traumatic dreams, I would say. And it occurs to me that, like, look, New York has been spoiled during this same exact era, right? The Yankees won a million titles, but what the Knicks were, what they represent, they're a culture, they're something that doesn't exist anymore, almost because they decided to exist.
They are so different to where I don't think the sport would look recognizable to people that only started watching basketball over the last 10 years. And I don't think people put two and two together all the time, but what I would argue is that the Knicks were as responsible for the game kind of leaping into the generation that it's in now as anybody, because I think the league could not have them playing the way they did anymore. They wanted to reduce the amount of physicality. So the Knicks were, you know, a team that was kind of foremost in the conversation about hand checking. They would do these tutorials around the league and go team by team and training camps to show them what would no longer be allowed. And the hand checking was one of the first things to go. That was no longer going to be allowed. They were bringing the three-point line in, which seems like it would kind of compress the game further, but it's actually the opposite. By bringing the three-point line in, all of a sudden, guys can shoot from closer in and get 3 points for it. So it forces guys that normally would only hang out at the rim defensively and just kind of stay tethered to the rim, it forces them out further defensively to try to guard those guys so that they're not giving up 3 points easily. That was spacing out the game a little bit more. There were all sorts of rules as it related to fighting. It used to be that you could swing at someone and you weren't necessarily going to get suspended for it because you didn't land the punch, which is a completely idiotic rule. But, you know, so that was changed. Now it was if you even tried to fight, you were going to get suspended. If you left the bench, you were going to get suspended. Yeah. I have a video that I commissioned someone to make that, you know, is basically a trailer for the book. And there's one sequence in it. There was just this huge fight at one point between the Bulls and the Knicks during that 94 season that the Knicks would go to the finals. And it happens right in front of David Stern and his wife.
And now we've got a play with Harper and English. Look out. Look down. Into the stand. Right in front. Oh, my. Look out. We've got everybody. We've got punches thrown. Ewing, Cartwright. It's right in front of us. Oh, this is ugly. Right in front of the commissioner. Right in front of the commissioner of the NBA, David Stern.
And David Stern has the most mortified look on his face. He's watching his league, you know, basically without Michael Jordan, and he's watching something that has the potential to go away if the league just becomes the WWF. And so they started changing rules right at that moment. A lot of that, I think, is because of those Knicks, that they were so counterculture. The league did not want teams like the Knicks to really be running the table.
Wait a minute, Chris. I think we've actually solved the religious question that we started this podcast with, because what the Knicks are, they are the team that sacrificed themselves and all of their ugliness for the betterment, for the glory of everyone else.
I'd agree with that. Doc Rivers was one of my favorite people to talk to for the book, and he says that repeatedly. He was the first one to complain about the anti-Knick rules being put in place and saying that, you know, those were put in place to hurt us. He's also the first person to tell you that, like, look, we had to get away from the way the game was being played. Like, we were probably the main ones doing that. But also, like, look at how beautiful the game is now. To people that think that this book is merely going to be something that is singing the praises of the way the game was played, or saying that it was so much better back then, it's not that. And even the people that I'm quoting throughout the book are not saying that. They all realize that the game needed to evolve and needed to change. But there is something kind of beautiful in a really ugly way about the way the game was played back then that allowed it to evolve the way it did. Knicks fans certainly found it to be beautiful. And I think that they would certainly take that era over the one they have now, just based on the way things have played out.
Chris Herring, thank you so much for your work. And on behalf of New York City, you're welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, man. I really appreciate you.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.